Hi, this is Casey, and this is episode 16 of the Parent Teacher Podcast. This is what I've put together to help get information out to any parents, teachers, related service providers that want to help kids who are kind of stuck in the school system, particularly, and want to help them become more successful and eventually become independent adults. I work primarily as a special education advocate. I work with a lot of kids with ADHD or twice exceptional backgrounds, and it's my goal to come on here regularly. I won't commit to weekly, and bring in experts and talk about things that are relevant to education of all kinds of learners. This week, thanks for joining me. I have an audiologist here to talk about central auditory processing disorder. All right, so I am here with Dr. Ferry. Could you tell me a little bit about what it is you do?
I'm a certified audiologist. And by the way, thank you very much for having me this morning. I've been an audiologist since 1979, specializing in evaluation and treatment of central auditory processing disorders in children and adults.
And the way that I met you is many, many years ago. My own daughter was receiving services through early intervention for speech, and we were seeing an occupational therapist. And at one point, it was recommended that we go ahead and check on her hearing because she had passed the hearing test that they administered at Lurie. It was interesting to watch little kid, the bunny popping up,
yes. You
know, and it was clear that she was hearing sounds, but she wasn't really responding to us in the way that we would expect. And we were wondering what was up. And one thing that you had told me at that time that I've never forgotten is that sensory is sensory. So, you know, frequently people talk about sensory processing disorder and they're seeing an occupational therapist talking about crossing the midline, or kids who are really hypersensitive to tags and clothing and foods, or kids who are hyposensitive and are hyperactive and slamming themselves all over the place. But we don't often link that with the vision piece and the hearing piece.
That is correct. Yeah.
And so, you know, having the special ed background, especially, I thought, wow, I've never even considered this. And it never left my mind. And sure enough, it made so much sense that she was having a hard time discriminating between sounds. And I'll say that now she does really well. And I think that putting together the reading piece, especially with the speech, you know, and just kind of having everything come together, it's not even a noticeable thing at this point, but it was really valuable information.
Right.
So that's why. And also in my work with clients as an advocate, I've seen a few evaluations you've done that really gave us good insight on kids.
Yeah.
So thanks for coming.
Thank you.
And I want to kind of lead with, I always tell people, I want to know, like, what have you learned and what should families know or what questions to ask? But before we met to record today, we were talking earlier in the week. And one of the things we were talking about was ADHD and performance in the classroom, and how I get frustrated when people are saying, well, the kids can ask for clarification. Well, the kids can, you know, double check with the teacher. They can ask. And I always push back on having the kids take responsibility for it. And you had said, do you know which part I'm talking about? When a kid is lost and then they'll try to get help.
Oh, right. That sometimes what will happen is a parent or a teacher will say, well, what part didn't you hear, or what part don't you understand, which is backwards, because if you didn't hear it and you didn't understand it, then you get that deer in the headlights look, like all of it. And we as communicators, and I was explaining this to one of my students just the other day, I said, as the presenter, as the speaker, as the teacher, I have a responsibility to be as clear as I possibly can be in my speech, in my language, to provide as much information as I can so that the listener has everything they need in order to process the information. And then by the same token, the listener's responsibility is to try to use all those cues that are there, the auditory cues, the visual, their own intelligence, their language capabilities, to pull it all together and to stop then and say, hey, wait a minute, you said there were three things you wanted me to do, I'm only hearing two. And to be brave enough to raise their hand and say, I missed something. I'm not quite sure what I missed, but I missed something. And then the give and take, I think, can be the speaker saying, tell me what you heard, or tell me what you think I want you to do. And then I, as the speaker, get your response, and I can say, right, you misheard that page number, or no, I didn't say which one I wanted you to point to. I want the one that's not fitting in, and I can fill in. And but there's this back and forth, and my concern is that we've become very I talk, you talk, instead of I talk, you listen, you talk, I listen, and having it actually be that give and take, as opposed to just this turn-taking kind of a scenario.
Like a meaningful exchange, and not just any response is a response.
Exactly.
Because
exactly.
What I'm thinking of in the classroom is, we call it a check for understanding, and it's frequently listed as an accommodation for kids.
Yes.
Within a 504 or an IEP, it'll say, you know, checks for understanding. And a good example of that is just what you described. So in your words, tell me, what do you need to do first and what do you need
That's
to do
right.
next?
To paraphrase, but not necessarily parrot. Because especially when it comes to auditory processing, certainly if you can repeat exactly what someone said, well, then you auditorily, you got it. But that's only part of the process of processing. There's the auditory component. What did I hear at the level of the ear and in the brain? Then the next step is the language processing component. What do I know? And then finally, the final step is, what can I do with this information? So having students repeat verifies that they heard it properly. Having students paraphrase lets you know that they understood what they were supposed to do. And even with these accommodations, I've seen repeat and rephrase that we will tell teachers. Those are two different things. I repeat to you in order to ensure that you heard everything I said. I rephrase to you if I suspect that you didn't understand a vocabulary word I used or a concept. And so the point of doing the testing that I do is to help figure out where along that process of skills the breakdown is occurring. That if it's fundamentally a hearing problem, either at the peripheral level or within the auditory brain, then I'm going to do something slightly differently from an intervention standpoint than if those sensory skills are intact, but my issue is more, I don't understand, or I can't do what you want me to do because of some other problem.
So when you say periphery, do you mean, I think of like deaf and hard of hearing.
Yes, that is accurate. That
and
the peripheral system is outer ear, middle ear, inner ear, and the auditory nerve. And any breakdown along that part of the process is considered a peripheral hearing loss. And certainly children who may have lots of fluid in their ears, they're going to suffer from a conductive hearing loss. The signal is blocked as it's trying to get into the inner part of the system. Our students who are identified as deaf and hard of hearing very likely have some sort of problem with their inner ear or the auditory nerve, because that first point of receiving the information is somehow broken down. Anything past the auditory nerve is by definition called a central auditory problem, because it is central to the system and it's all what the brainstem and the brain is doing with it. But even then, it breaks down into a half a dozen or more separate little individual tasks that first the system has to accomplish and then the person has to accomplish. And we as observers of human behavior, just as you're walking down the street or sitting at the cafe and watching tourists go by, all we ever see is the output. We see what people are doing. Mm. And if they're not doing what we want them to do, that's not the problem. that's a symptom of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so by doing a comprehensive evaluation with an audiologist, a speech language pathologist, the psychologist, the social worker, the OTPT, you figure out what's driving the bus.
Right.
And is that attention behavior in the classroom, the student who's looking out the window and appears not to be paying attention, is it an attention problem? Or is it, I'm so overloaded by so much sensory stuff in this space, I have to check out? Or you're using vocabulary that I don't understand, and so I'm checking out.
Mm-hmm.
And so as we put all these assessment pieces together, we're able to look at that student who didn't follow directions and answer the question, why? And I mentioned to you the other day, I think maybe not to you, but somebody else, an adult client I had who asked me, she said, you didn't ask me to follow complex directions in background noise. And I said, no. And she said, but you have to test it. And I said, no, you said you can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I don't need to test it. I said, I believe you when you tell me you can't follow complex directions and background noise. And I said, you didn't come to me to validate that real life problem. You came to me to find out why you can't follow directions. Is it a hearing problem? Is it a auditory brain problem? Is it a language problem? Is it an execution problem?
Right. So to make a quick analogy and make sure that I'm on the same page and this is clear, if we were to think in terms of vision, you know, the peripheral system might be something like a cataract, something physically like with the eye that prevents the stimulus or the information from even entering the brain. Right?
Yes.
And so that would be the case if somebody had a hearing screening and didn't pass.
Yes.
Because there's fluid or there's some sort of hearing loss. And honestly, in some cases, with some effort or amplification, they may still be able to,
absolutely,
you know, carry
that's,
through the task.
Absolutely.
But the analogy for central auditory processing deficits or issues or disorder, and you can maybe clear that up too, would be more like a specific like dyslexia, where we find that there's a processing issue that's specific to the way the brain interprets the information.
Yeah, that's fairly accurate. I see a lot of students who've been diagnosed with dyslexia. And in fact, the terminology, there's still many neuropsychologists who are using the term dysphonetic dyslexia. And the minute I hear dysphonetic dyslexia, I'm thinking, right, that's why you had them call me, because that suggests that these dyslexic characteristics are driven by some sort of an auditory impairment. And then there's dysidetic dyslexia, which is your dyslexic characteristics are driven by some sort of a visual problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so the my diagnosis isn't designed to undo anybody else's. I'm not in a position to say, oh, your student's not dyslexic. But again, it's about why,
mm-hmm,
are we seeing this behavior? Same thing with attention deficit disorder. Finding an auditory processing problem does not rule out an ADD, but it at least says, hey, there's a contributing and coexisting factor here that needs to be addressed. Even in the case of a student with who's deaf and hard of hearing, you can have a central deficit and a peripheral,
mm-hmm,
problem. I myself have a visual acuity issue and on top of that, a visual processing disorder. And you mentioned the disorder deficit thing. I just got an email,
mm-hmm,
the other day asking me about that. The term we use is central auditory processing disorder,
mm-hmm,
to label sort of the class of problems. And when I write up a report, I may say in the report, results have indicated presence of a central auditory processing disorder characterized by a deficit in,
okay,
and then I itemize the skill set, because under that umbrella, there are many, many, many possibilities. And so it's not an auditory processing disorder, it's several auditory processing disorders.
Okay.
And so again, the testing helps to tease that out. If the underlying problem is your brain can't analyze these pieces of information, like in your daughter's case, the discrimination component.
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, I'm going to treat that differently than if the problem is I have all my parts, but I can't put them together into a usable whole.
Mm-hmm.
The training will be different. And in fact, some of the accommodations are going to be slightly different. If I can analyze and synthesize, but I can't attach meaning, well, I'm putting a call into the speech language pathologist,
right,
because the emphasis of the intervention will be very, very language based.
Right.
If I can analyze and synthesize and attach meaning, but I can't get my ducks in a row to execute an appropriate response, well, now I'm circling back around to OT or the neuropsychologist to look at those frontal lobe supported executive skills that help us with organization and planning and execution.
So let me break down analyze and synthesize just a little bit. And I'm thinking of in cases where people have come to you, it's often because we try an intervention that seems like your first line intervention. You have a kid who's, let's say, struggling to learn to read fluently. And I had Kristen McShane on recently, and we talked about Orton-Gillingham based phonics intervention. And in some cases, it should be working.
Yes.
And then a kid hits like a very like firm plateau, and we just cannot make progress. And that's when I would say we need to look into the auditory component.
Yes.
So yeah. At what stage does that fall in? Is that fairly common?
Yes. We actually were seeing an uptick in, at least I am, an uptick in some older students coming in, and we're finding a breakdown, particularly in the analysis skills. That these kids have probably had their whole lives, but they've worked around it. They're intelligent, because none of this is about how smart you are. It's about, I tell my kids, it's about having a stone in your shoe.
Mm-hmm.
And your job as a third grader is to run over there to fourth grade. And everybody else is, you're trying to run as fast as they are, but you have a stone in your shoe, which means you can't run as fast. You got to keep stopping. And so the therapy we're going to do is designed to try to get the stone out of your shoe. And this analysis component is the skill set auditorily that is most foundational within the auditory skills. It's all about the system's ability to pull out pitch cues and loudness cues and timing cues. And so by the time it gets to my brain, I've got my k or my a or my ts, whatever my sounds are. Then I go the next step of pulling all those sounds together and then attaching meaning and then using it.
Okay.
And that analytic component happens before we're even aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't know you made a mistake until after you made the mistake.
Mm.
And so you're potentially the student who's on page 56 when you should be on page 66.
Okay.
Or you're the student who did problems 3, 4, and 5 when the teacher said do problems 3 through 9.
Right.
And an oversimplification, but I think one that kind of makes the point, is think about it in terms of, on this side we have say the word dog, say the word tree, say the word cat. Clearly that's an auditory skill. I don't need you to think about it. I don't need you to write anything. I just need you to say what you heard. On this side we have tell me something about a cat. And yeah, you have to have heard it, but the demand there is much higher level. I need to stop and think about now, well, what do you want to know about cats? And how much should I tell you? And well, and that's a lot of language, a lot of cognition. So a listener who has an auditory-based problem may be the student who says, oh, you need that to play baseball. Because they understood the question,
mm-hmm.
but they misheard the target.
They heard bat.
They heard bat instead of cat.
Right.
Whereas the student who heard it fine, but has some sort of an issue that relates more to something just past the auditory, more related to the language, or pulling everything together, might actually stare at you blankly because they're not sure how to answer. Or they look at you and say, well, what do you want to know about cats? Or my favorite is the student who says, oh, I don't like cats. They answered the question, but because of what they caught, they didn't synthesize the information. And so all they heard was cats. And so the response was, they heard, what? You know, tell me cats. I don't like cats. I didn't catch everything.
So it sounds like, you know, one way I understand language is there's receptive, there's taking in, right? And then there's the internal process of making sense of it and attaching it to meaning, which is what you're talking about. And then the other piece of it, which, and this is what makes assessment so tricky, is that it's the behavior that we yes. can observe. And so I feel, and correct me if I'm wrong, like you're really trying to assess the processing, the receptive processing. If it's an issue with the expressive piece where we can be sure that they heard the right thing, then that is something that might be dealt with more by a speech language
yes,
pathologist.
Speech language pathologist or a psychologist. And so what I believe that my assessments offer to the big picture is that deep testing in that receptive realm. And certainly if there's a true auditory component, it will make itself apparent on these tests for children as young as six. I mean, mm-hmm. these are very reliable, very valid measures. If there is a significant language component, the pattern of performance across the tests is quite different than if it's a purely auditory. And in fact, I can look at my numbers and turn around and say to a parent, we're going to need to talk to a neuropsychologist because this has all the earmarks of something that is expressive. Mm. And the idea of auditory expression is just, no, it's expression is what you do with it. And even auditory comprehension is a misnomer because the minute you step into comprehension, reasoning, understanding, you've crossed the line into language. And so it's not auditory comprehension, it's comprehension of what we hear.
Okay.
It's not auditory memory, it's memory for what we hear. And we can't do any of that unless you link it to language.
I would imagine that there can be some signs of this that point to you
yes.
should do the testing. Like one example is my daughter would say things like the controller instead
yes.
of the remote
yes.
control. So
yes.
there were words that were slightly mispronounced
yes.
or like overgeneralized sounds.
Yes.
And I think that just developmentally kids start.
Some of that is developmental, yes.
But then, like you were saying, we have kids who are older kids and somehow they've learned to read. And I see this frequently where they're not even identified as having any type of a disability, but they're really anxious. And I'm always like looking and I'm thinking, they're reading whole words.
Yes.
They're relying on memorization.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. The kinds of things, I mean, the list is just, it's this laundry list of potential issues that relate to auditory, because auditory affects our academics, it affects our communication, it affects how we feel about ourselves. And so you can see these articulation problems that won't go away, or you can see these mispronunciations, problems in reading, problems in spelling, problems in language, but also, yes, problems in anxiety. My parents say they work so hard. They just seem to work harder than they should have to work. And I was asked, and I've been asked repeatedly, you know, what are the red flags? And I'm like, they're not red flags as much as they're pink. They're because, yes, the same behaviors that might tell somebody, oh, it could be attention deficit. Those could be the same behaviors for a student with an auditory issue or a language issue. That's the whole point of doing the differential testing,
mm-hmm.
is to figure out why are those behaviors happening. And I'm going to give you just one more example that I think
yeah.
makes the point. I know of two individuals, they presented with headache. One was 15 and one was 39. And the 39-year-old, headache that wouldn't go away, so bad, had come back from vacation, walked across his living room, said, oh, my head, dropped to the floor, had a blown aneurysm.
Whoa.
Okay, so headache, right, headache could be an aneurysm. The 15-year-old, headache that wouldn't go away, they tried everything. And finally, the doctor said, I'm going to do a blood test. And this was long enough ago that the family walked to the doctor and walked home. By the time they walked back to the house, the doctor had done the analysis of the blood, called the house and said, take her to the hospital right now. She had a ruptured appendix, and headache isn't a presenting complaint for a ruptured appendix. She didn't have any of the symptoms of
right.
appendicitis. But the doctor, God love him, did a test and said, here's why you have a headache. Your appendix is on the verge of rupturing. We need to take the appendix out. And I'm so grateful for that, because that 15-year-old, 14 years later, had me. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, way to go, doc. Mm-hmm. Do a test.
Right.
And I get that that we don't want to overtest kids. But if you have a student in front of you and you still, the hair on the back of your neck is standing up, you're thinking, I just, then it's a couple of hours of time and it's a little bit of money. And then you've got another piece that either rules out the auditory as the contributing factor or rules it in right. as a contributing factor. And now we can add to the intervention package.
Yeah, and it's going to help us select interventions that are effective.
Yes, that are effective for that deficit type.
Right.
And not simply the interventions that fit with that umbrella term, because there's plenty of generic things that'll work for lots of kids. But like I said, even repeat and rephrase. If your problem's auditory, repetition is a great way to go. If your problem's language, repetition will not work because it does not make the signal any more linguistically clear. So we have to do a better job as professionals on the assessment side of the equation in order to get more bang for our buck mm-hmm. on the intervention side.
Well, and I agree. And I would say I also have a background. I taught ESL, so language learners. And I learned that another thing is, you know, temperament in kids. And having them repeat isn't as good as rephrase. But the worst thing you can say is, did you catch all of that?
Yes,
because you're going to get like, yes, yep,
no,
sure. Because they're
right
getting
that
a headache.
That's
just
right.
Just thinking about it. I'm going to summarize what we said, but then also I'm curious about like what the tasks look like, if you can explain it. But really, I think what we're saying is like the pink flags could be responses that don't quite match up to a question.
Yes.
They could be like Dibbles testing is really commonly done, segmenting words and blending
yes.
sounds back
blending
together.
Sounds.
We frequently see that with learning
yes.
disabilities.
Yes.
And the other thing might be that people think there's an attention issue or even an attitude problem.
An attitude problem, right?
Really frequently see like they do great when they're motivated.
Yes,
and I'm like,
they do great
when they're like high interest
exactly,
and the supports are
yeah.
appropriate.
Yeah.
Like
problems
we don't want to blame
music.
The kid. Right.
Problems with
okay.
music is huge. Children who are really struggling with music and rhythms or don't like music, that's probably as close to a red flag as you can get, because that's just not normal.
Like tone deafness or being offbeat?
Offbeat. One mom said that as an infant, even holding her son in her arms, that she would sing to him, and this little infant was putting his hand up over his mother's mouth.
Oh, that's my kids.
And she said, well, I know I don't sing really great. She said, but still, and didn't want the radio on, and because if your brain can't wrap itself around music as a processed piece of information, if it's just noise, then you're going to experience, you know, a dislike of music or a lack of appreciation. And that's probably the closest thing to a red flag, or that kids who their timing seems to be off. But it's also things like not following directions or only following part of the directions. Mm-hmm. A lot of, you know, I can't hear. I think some of these kids are telling you the truth. They say, I can't hear. And then we test their hearing and somebody says, but you can hear just fine. And the kids, but I can't hear.
Right.
And they sometimes know. I'm just always astounded at how well even these young children kind of know what their problem is, but they don't have the vocabulary mm-hmm. to get all the grown-ups around them to understand the issues.
Yeah,
so.
I see the same thing. Kids will frequently tell me like, well, I can read it. But when I'm done reading it, I didn't understand and I don't remember it. And they read
yeah.
it like with, you know, yeah. correct phrasing
yeah.
and expression. So kind of to wrap up, I think that was really clear. These are all indicators that you may want to go see an audiologist.
Yes.
Right. Is there a pediatric audiologist?
Pediatric audiologists technically are the under five crowd
okay.
kind of by definition.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually an educational audiologist.
Okay.
The most of my practice are school age. So the under 21, I see kids as young as 4, but my oldest client was 84. So I see
okay.
adults as well. You do want to make sure that it is an audiologist who does have some advanced knowledge and skills in auditory processing. This is not something that you can just sort of dabble in. I taught my then 12-year-old how to do all the tests.
Okay.
Because running a test is pretty easy.
Yeah.
The art here is the interpretation.
Right.
And figuring out what all these different numbers mean, you know, well, you did well here, but you did poorly here. And we look at all of that. We look at where you do well and where you do poorly on this battery of tests that's going to overwork the auditory system. This is so complex neurologically up here. We overwork it to see how efficiently it operates. And by looking at your performance against an age match peer group, if you're breaking down at the same levels as everybody else, you're fine. If you're breaking down too soon, that's a potential problem. Then I look at the entire battery to figure out, oh, you have a deficit in analysis, or you don't have any auditory problems at all, whatever. And then I can do deficit-specific intervention. And I'd love to come back sometime and talk about deficit-specific interventions.
Well, we were having so much fun talking, I suppose, this happens frequently, that we got cut off. But I'm hoping that we can have Dr. Ferry back, because she said that she's pretty excited about some of the interventions available now, especially the computer-based programs that do some of the training of the ear. There's a lot of research backing that. And I just wanted to summarize and say it's very helpful to have all of the information when you're not quite sure what's going on with a kid, and having an evaluation by an audiologist who is aware of how these things can impact learning and participation in the classroom is really good information to bring to your team. And that expert can also write a list of recommendations that you can share when you're developing the 504 or the IEP. If you have any questions for me or for Dr. Ferry, or you'd like a list of resources, look in the show notes, or you can contact me through my website, which is reorientedadvocacy.com. Thank you.